Hello, and welcome to Season 5 of Human Awareness, the official podcast for High Global, where we take you on a journey through love, intimacy, and sexuality. I'm your host, Haya, and I'm inviting our guests to open their hearts and their experience so we can all learn together. Okay, with that out of the way, let's roll tape on our interview. Hello, and welcome back to Human Awareness, the podcast for High Global. I'm joined here with a very new friend. We just had a beautiful little introduction conversation, and I can't wait to get into the meat of this. Would you share your name and what your pronouns are?
Sure. My full name is Sumati Sparks. A lot of my friends call me Sumi for short, and my pronouns are she, her.
Beautiful. Where in the world are you?
I'm in Oakland, California right now, but I'm a bit of a nomad.
We talked about some really interesting topics we might get into, and I'm in this really wonderful heart space right now in that I just came back from a high workshop and I'm like, my cup is full, my heart is open. I have this beautiful post-workshop glow and I just feel connected to the world in a way that is really quite rare and wonderful. One of the topics that came up for me a lot this weekend was relationships and various ways of having relationships. And that is one of the things that you are particularly interested in.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm a relationship geek.
Nice. What brought you towards being a relationship geek?
I think it was just inherent, you know. Like, I didn't do very well in school at math and engineering and science, but I did really good with language. And I always had a lot of friends and I started having steady boyfriends in seventh grade. So just a lot of natural life experience, you know, based on who I am. I can do a brief summary that led me to calling myself the open relationship coach, if you like.
I feel like a lot of people are going through a transition from, you know, the society's default assumption of monogamy, mm-hmm. and then discovering that maybe that isn't for them. I would love to hear what your journey was there. Like, when did you discover that open relationships were a thing for you?
Mm-hmm. Having worked with people for many years now, I see that people choose or fall into or can't help but be in open relationships. So having coached people for many years, I see that people come to open relationship from many different places. They might never have thought they were going to be in open relationship, but they fall in love with somebody who wants that and they try their best to make it work and they may succeed or may not. Some people can kind of take it or leave it depending on who they're with. But there's people like me for whom open relationship is kind of an identity, like being gay. So not everybody who practices open relationship has that kind of identification with it. But I know for me, after all these years, I can say that I would not thrive long term in a monogamous relationship. I can be in one for a year or two if we decide to do that to create stability in our relationship and security. But long term, I know that I would get bored and I'd be itching for something else. To really be thriving in my life, just to be a full expression of who I am. So I've learned that about myself. But, you know, go back to before I went to high, I didn't know there was an option of being honestly non-monogamous. You know, I just thought cheating was the only option. So that's usually what I did. I would usually cheat on a partner. Relationship would last 2 or 3 years. I'd start an affair with somebody else, I'd leave the prior partner and then go with a new partner. And so they kind of overlapped. And I wasn't proud of myself at all about that. You know, I felt like I was a total jerk. So then I went to high and I saw Stan Dale with his long-term wife, Helen, and his less long-term wife, Janet. And they all were sleeping in the same bedroom. And it was like, mind blown. You know, I was just like, what? This is so cool. And they were all such wonderful people. You know, like you couldn't deny that they had their shit together and that they were quality, open-hearted people, being transparent about the way they were living. And then I also met a man in the high workshop in my first level one who told me how his wife was with her boyfriend that weekend while he was at the workshop. And again, mind blown, you know, like, what? So I went with my then boyfriend. He'd been in high for a while. And so I was just, my first exposure to this kind of community and this kind of life. I didn't do the workshop with my boyfriend. He wanted me to do level one by myself. So I went, I loved it. I believe he and I did the couples workshop. They used to have couples level one, couples level two back then. This is in the late 90s. So we did couples level one. And then I went to level two with the boyfriend. During that workshop, I met another man who I was very attracted to. And my boyfriend saw that I was attracted to him. And he said, it's okay if you wanted to see him after the workshop. He said, I just think of that as an extension of the workshop. And I was like, really? Oh my gosh. So I would go on dates with this guy, and this guy was also equally cool about it, where he would say, you better call your primary partner and let him know that we're, doing this thing, that we're escalating to, sex, or we're escalating to kink, or whatever, every level we went to in our intimacy, he wanted to make sure the other guy knew about it and was in consent and everything. So that just blew my mind to have these two men in my life that were so conscious and so willing to take care of each other too.
Mm.
So that was like my first experience with people like that. And I wasn't very good at it in the beginning. I still had my habit of lying, but then I would not keep the lie for very long. Like after a couple of days, I'd say, I didn't tell you that I saw so-and-so last week. I'm so sorry. And I'd cry and I'll get better, So it just took me a while to like change those neuronal pathways around, oh, this has to be hidden and secret. Mm-hmm. I had to learn, and that was 25 years ago now.
That feels like a really powerful thing to realize. Like you mentioned that you felt bad, maybe you experienced shame around like feeling like you kind of couldn't help cheating. Is that what I heard?
It felt like, a compulsion in a way, because it was a shadow, and I know now that when you repress a true part of yourself, it usually leaks out somewhere and comes out in dishonest, destructive, mm-hmm. or shame-like behavior. Yeah.
And so what was it like for you to realize that there was a different path where you fulfilled those parts of you
mm-hmm.
in a way that was kind of open and ethically non-monogamous?
Well, I think, like I said, I think it took me a minute to really get the joy in that, because I had this momentum going where something's wrong with me. I have to hide it. I have to feel ashamed. So even as I had two wonderful men who were super honest and open, I still didn't know how to be with that for a while. So those two relationships crashed and burned. And then I eventually got into a relationship with I think the next one after that had been polyamorous for like 30 years at that point. And his wife also maybe 20 years. So they had so much experience, and they made it so normal. They normalized non-monogamy so comfortably mm-hmm. that I think I finally picked up on that vibe that like, oh, this is great. I get to love this man and be friends with his wife and be friends with her other boyfriends. And then we developed this polycule or this community, and I thought, wow. Then I started to really feel like this is life, this is living.
Right.
I think like a gay person would feel when they finally found a community of other LGBTQ people. That's how it ultimately felt. But it took me a minute to really let that sink in and get that I could also be transparent.
Yeah. One of the things that often comes up for people as they're making transitions like that is jealousy, specifically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did that show up for you at all?
Oh, yeah. And I think that was probably the main reason why I was hiding, because I was afraid that if my partner knew that I was seeing someone else, that they would also want to see someone else. So I wanted to be the only one. Like I wanted a poly mono is what we call it now, where I was poly and they weren't, but they didn't want that. So I was hiding it so I wouldn't have to deal with their other relationships. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got involved with the married guy, and I was involved with him for 5 years. And, to be involved with someone who's been married and have children together and a household and his whole life, and then they go on vacations together. Like that was immersion therapy. Like I had to mm-hmm. really figure out my shit, and how am I going to be with this? So that was the crucible for me to really own my jealousy. And I think that I did okay with it, but I didn't get to an advanced level of jealousy management where I can actually teach other people until that relationship with the married guy ended. And it was a lot around jealousy, because for the first year that we were together, I just considered myself his secondary, that he was married and I was his secondary partner. But then his wife got really involved with one of her other partners and started spending all her time with him, which left the husband for me, and we became primary partners for 3 years. Mm-hmm. But then her other relationship ended and they came back together, and I kept asking for us to all talk. Like, I wanted a kitchen table situation where we could all sit around and talk about these changes and how we felt about it and what we needed. But this is where I learned all the differences. And now I have a system that I teach where we talk about the 5 major archetypes of non-monogamy. And one of them is kitchen table and another is parallel. So they wanted parallel polyamory where, you know, sure, we know each other, we could come together in groups, but mostly the relationships are separate dyads, whereas mm-hmm. I wanted more kitchen table, what I now jokingly refer to as king size bed polyamory, because not necessarily that we're all lovers, but that we can all just lay on the bed together and cuddle and talk. Like, I want mm-hmm. that much closest. The kitchen table is, there's too much in the way. There's this big table in between us. I'd mm-hmm. rather us be able to touch and cuddle and hug. And I'm in a community now that's like that. It's called New Culture. And it's kind of like high on steroids, because, you know, high workshops are 48 hours, but the New Culture events are 6 to 10 days. Mm-hmm. So we just go way deeper into those relationships. I love that kind of closeness with my metamors. And for people that don't know, a metamor is your partner's other partner. So someone that I'm not lovers with, but we share the same lover. Yep. So I like a lot of closeness with my metamor, where we can be best friends. And we can cuddle and we can have threesomes together. We can just all be as close as possible. And my married guy wanted separate dyads. And I didn't know that we had this difference until he and his wife started coming back together again. I thought we were on the same page and that we did everything the same way. And then I realized, oh, I'm not going to get my needs met here. I'm not going to be able to talk about what's going on, these changes that are happening. So I finally had to just remove myself from the situation, and I went through a huge heartbreak, and that led me down the rabbit hole of trauma. Like, it triggered old trauma for me. And I came out the other side of that, you know, yearning for, like, what happened? I know I can't go back to monogamy. So how can I do non-monogamy in a way where I'm not going to be this traumatized again? And mm-hmm. so that's when I started doing intense research about jealousy and triggers and different styles of non-monogamy and, you know, all the different things that I teach now. So that was a blessing in disguise, because it instigated my new career, which I love now.
The phrase breakdown to breakthrough has shown up for a lot for me over the last couple of weeks. And it sounds like that was part of your journey, is like being reduced to pieces just to be able to kind of put yourself back together again.
Yeah, I think when we go through those kind of core trauma, you know, those healing crises, we have to make a decision. Like, am I going to just die? You know, am I going to either off myself or just stay depressed or, you know, go into addictive behavior, which I have a history of, or am I going to choose life? You know, and if I'm going to choose life, I have to go through this pain and I have to get the support I need. And I love how you talked about just coming back from a workshop this past weekend where you feel so full of love and life because you have that community, you have that support. And that's so essential. I mean, yeah, we need a good therapist. Yeah, we need to have good self-care skills. But dude, we need our communities. You know, we need that, because the default culture doesn't have our backs as far as how we want to live our life.
Yeah. I've been in relationships where jealousy seems really taboo. It's like, it's a bad thing. You're not allowed to have jealousy. But then jealousy just happens. Mm-hmm. And you just used the phrase jealousy management. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit more. What does mm-hmm. that look like?
I'm actually writing a book right now about jealousy. So,
Amazing. Well, I'm talking to the right person here.
Yeah. I mean, it's called Transforming Jealousy into Love, but it's just a doorway for me to tell a lot of my story and to share how I've come to have these tools that I teach now, how mm-hmm. I've, through my own experience, my own falling on my face, I've learned how to thrive in this kind of love style. Mm-hmm. So, jealousy, there is in the default world, kind of this belief that it's my job to keep my partner from ever feeling jealous. And so let me just say that in another way that can be a revolutionary thought for a lot of people. It's not my job to keep my partner from feeling jealous. Mm-hmm. It's not my job to keep my partner from feeling jealous. Now that can be revolutionary for a lot of people. Like, what? Mm-hmm. What do you mean? You're just going to go around and make me jealous all the time? No, I'm a kind person. I love my partner. I want him to be happy. So I'm not going to intentionally go around and try to make him jealous. And if I do, he shouldn't be with me, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm like that cruel. But if I do something where I'm just saying hi to an ex-boyfriend or going to a class reunion or something that might stimulate my partner feeling jealous, that's his work to do. And my job is to hold the space for his feelings, to give him the gift of presence and empathy. So this is a phrase I've come up with because I don't like when we say, just listen. I need mm-hmm. you to just listen. Because so often when one person's having a strong feeling, the other one wants to get in there and either defend themselves, fix the other person's feeling, tell them they shouldn't be having it or something like that. And so mm-hmm. we often have to say, I just want you to listen. But when we put the word just in there, it minimizes listening. Mm. Right? Do you know, being in high, that listening is one of the best gifts we can ever give someone? It's not a just. So I've been calling it giving the gift of presence and empathy. So when you can give that gift of presence without advice, without fixing, without defending yourself and making it about you, like just putting my own stuff aside and being there for my partner's experience and feelings, and then give them empathy for it. It doesn't mean I have to agree with it. Mm. Giving empathy doesn't mean you're agreeing. You're just saying, wow, it must feel really hard. You know, that sounds like it's really hard for you, right? Yep. So that's what we can do when our partner feels jealous. And then, you know, when they feel heard and received and loved, then maybe they need some reassurance. You know, would you like some reassurance? Is there anything I can do to support you? They might say like, yeah, it's really hard to do, but I've learned to do this, is to say, my partner just asked me the other day, he goes, well, what are the exact words you need to hear? And I go, I need to hear that I'm wanted, because I've done so much work on myself that I know that's the core wound, is feeling unwanted. Mm-hmm. Like when I hear those words, like, I want you here. I really want you. I'm so glad you're here with me. So I said those kinds of words when I'm feeling triggered, it really soothes me.
Yeah.
So if we get good at learning what we want, we can ask specifically for it. Our partner can give it to us, and then it can diffuse a conflict so quickly. You know, because usually when we're in conflict in a relationship, we just want to be loved. You know, 99% of the time, we're just feeling unloved.
Right.
So I'm going off on a tangent, but I hope that.
Well, you just mentioned a phrase that I think is super important here, and it's core wound.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of the time, in my experience, when I've experienced jealousy, it's because it touches something that has very little to do with the specific situation, but makes Correct. Me feel unsafe, right? Mm-hmm. And the defense mechanisms, the walls come up, the defense mechanisms, any number of the ways of like trying to keep myself safe. And I forget that I'm with a partner who is safe. And my jealousy comes up in a way that is like, it's one of the most existential fears.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yes.
I'm blessed in that I've experienced jealousy maybe a handful of times in my life, but they were brutal.
Mm-hmm.
It is almost inconceivable how big that emotion is.
Jessica,
is that your
Fern
experience
called,
too?
Yeah, Jessica Fern calls it primal panic. She wrote the book Polysecure.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of all the rage right now in the community around how attachment styles can be healed in non-monogamous relationships, because most attachment theory books take you toward monogamy to heal.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first book where it talks about how can we have a secure polyamorous relationship, right? especially if we have attachment wounds. So she calls it primal panic when you get triggered in that, in your deepest core wounds.
Mm.
So yeah, there's a whole thing about trauma, and I didn't have the language back in, it was like this 16 years ago when I had the breakup with the married guy that kind of was a catalyst for me learning to teach this stuff. And I didn't have the language for trauma back then. I knew that my reaction was bigger than the situation called for. I knew it wasn't just a breakup with a boyfriend, you know?
Right.
I knew it was something really, really core, but I didn't know what to do with those feelings. And none of my friends knew what to do either. And every time somebody would try something with me, it would just make it worse, One guy sent me an email saying, you knew he was married. And I'm like, that doesn't help. That's like saying, you knew dogs only live 12 years.
Right. Why are you still want the that loss puppy. Of your dog? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then another person would say, you know, your ex and his wife aren't going to be at this party. Would you like to come? And I was like, I don't want to hear that, because then my mind starts going, well, where are they? Are they off on vacation together? I just needed a break to not hear from them at all. So, you know, everything somebody in the community would try would make it worse for me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know what to do. Nobody else knew what to do. But we have more language now around healing trauma. And what I've learned is to rely on community, to get clear on the kind of reassurance I need, and to be brave enough to ask for support and to not isolate. And so I've done this many times in recent years where I've gotten community support. I've said, can I just lay down in the middle of all of you guys and cry and have you just hold me and look into my eyes and say it's okay? And that can be the most healing thing ever. Mm-hmm. But God, is that scary to ask for when you're in that most vulnerable place?
Were you able to get to the bottom of your core wound? Like, do you know what was like really triggering that huge jealousy reaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, like I said, the core wound is feeling unwanted because my father was supposed to be, quote, babysitting me. That's what we called parenting. When men did parenting back in the 60s, we called it babysitting. So my mom started working when I was 4, and my dad was a salesman, so he had a more flexible schedule. So he was supposed to be babysitting me, but he was an alcoholic. So he would leave me in these random places to go drink. And one time my mom caught him leaving me in my stroller on the sidewalk while he went into a bar. And when she blasted him over it, he said, I could see her through the window. So, you know, as a little, like, you know, earlier than 4 years old, I was just being left in all these random places. And I can remember my dad driving away from me, and I'm chasing him in the car when I was 4. And he's just laughing and trying to get away from me. It was a big game to him. And so I remember when I was 4 years old, I made a decision that I would never let anyone be important to me again. I didn't have the words for that, but that was the nonverbal choice I made at that time. So then I go through my young adult life trying to get my needs met while not letting anyone be important to me, right? So it wasn't until I started doing a lot of therapy and personal growth work and high workshops that I could come to terms with that decision that I had made and start to soften that and to be brave enough to let someone be important to me. That takes a great act of courage.
And especially if that's a nonverbal choice, right? Getting back to it with therapy or with words. It's like, I imagine you have this sense of making yourself feel safe through doing something that you don't really even have words for.
I continue to learn about attachment theory. I busted myself the other day. I had a attachment theory specialist join my open relationship support group, which is an online group. She joined us, and she was so good at describing all the different attachment wounds and attachment styles that I finally heard myself in one of them because I couldn't identify, because I identified with both the anxious and the avoidant. And then I learned there was something called disorganized, where you swing between anxious and avoidant. So I'll feel anxious, but then when something happens where I feel hurt, I'll go to, you know, screw you, you don't matter to me. I'll go to the other extreme, like you're dead to me now. And so now I see myself doing that, because these core wounds never entirely heal. We just have to befriend them and bring lightness to them and love and sometimes even humor if we can. And so my partner came up to me the other day and he said, are you in your avoidant little girl right now? And that just melted me. Like, how sweet was that, you know? So we don't let it last for very long anymore. Like, we're working together to earn secure attachment with each other. So I'll notice myself swinging to that, you know, I'm out of here. You don't matter to me. And I'll notice it and I'll come back and I'll name it, you know, and I'll say, I'm really going into this avoidant place right now. And I'd like to come back together and talk about what happened. And fortunately, I have this glorious partner who will do that with me, who, if I'm coming from a vulnerable place like that and not blaming him or making him wrong, I mean, 99.9% of the time, he's totally open to talking about it and reassuring me and giving me whatever I need. So I feel super grateful that I've eventually be, you know, now I'm in my 60s. So don't, it's never too late, folks. Have the best relationship life, sex life, love life, community life, you know, ever now.
Beautiful.
So, you know, we all keep growing and expanding and keeps getting better.
I love that. So where do you begin? Like, if you are realizing that the language I often use is like, hey, this is a level 3 event, but there's a level 11 response. Like, there's just, you're sensing this mismatch.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you begin? How do you begin that journey of going, like, where is that wound? Where is that?
Mm-hmm. There's two directions I can go. Let me first go to the issue of being triggered. So if you're with your partner and one of you is triggered, like you said, the fight, flight, freeze, fawn, you know, you're in that primal part of your brain, you know, that's like the lizard brain.
Yeah.
You're no longer able to access your executive functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't see the nuances in relationship. You can only see, how can I stay safe? And so you literally see your partner, the person you love the most in the world, as a threat. So they become like a saber-toothed tiger who's trying to eat you, right? So I would say, don't try to talk to them about it. You can't. Mm. You literally, your brain can't do it. It's just going to escalate and get worse. So if you remember anything at all from this talk, please remember the timeout or the pause.
Mm-hmm.
You get to take a pause from your partner. And as you get better at taking the pauses, you can say, I need a short pause. I'll be back in 10 minutes. You can say, I love you and I need to go out for a couple hours. Or you can say, I think this is going to be like, I'll be back in the morning. Or, you know, if you can tell the person how long, that helps regulate their abandonment issues if they have them.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, whatever you need to do to just step away kindly, as soon as possible, when you notice one of you is triggered, take the time out. Okay, so you've taken the time out, you've separated from each other. Now you're with yourself. Everybody has different ways of regulating their nervous system. I like to talk to people. I'm a talker. So mm-hmm. I figure stuff out by talking. So I'll try to get a good friend on the phone, somebody who's experienced with non-monogamy, if it's about that, and talk it through and have a good cry with them. But you can also journal. The Byron Katie, The Work, is a really great tool for journaling. You can do a meditation. I really love the Who Am I, Zen Koan, just contemplating who am I? Because what that does is it separates you from the feelings, so you can observe the feelings. Because when you become the feelings, there's a feeling of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And you go down this rabbit hole into your trauma, and you feel like you start believing your thoughts that nobody loves me, la, la, la. But if you can stay a little detached from your feelings and notice them, like, oh, I'm having that rabbit hole feeling again where I'm going down. Okay,
right. What
can I do now? Like, so contemplating who am I, or what is life, or some kind of Zen Koan can really help you separate from that. So whatever you need to do, some people might go on a motorcycle ride or go for a run or play music or whatever you need to do to regulate your nervous system back to ground zero. Okay, mm-hmm. Then when you're calm again, now is a time when you can really look at, what is it that caused this trigger? Like, what in me was triggered? What childhood issue? What did I make this mean? You know, do some writing about it. And then when your nervous system is calm again, you can check in with your partner and see if theirs also is. And then you can both come back together and share, like, God, I'm sorry I blew up. Here's what was going on for me. It reminded me of when my aunt used to lock me in the closet when you slammed the door, or something like mm-hmm. that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then, you know, really feel that and share how scary that is. And then usually your partner will love you enough to say like, oh, I had no idea. You know, I had no idea you had that background. I can make sure I don't slam doors around you again, you know? So just coming from that place of vulnerability, like owning your trigger and not blaming the other person for it, can bring you back together with your partner. So that's one trajectory. The other trajectory is, what do you do about jealousy itself?
I think I initially, when you mentioned it, stumbled a little bit over the statement you had about you're not responsible for your partner's jealousy. Sure. And the additional words, I think, were really helpful there. So high has a lot of things about like, hey, you're responsible for your emotions. And that does feel good. But at the same time, you know, you don't get to be a jerk to your partner.
Correct.
And I'm finding like an interesting, like, what is the balance between kindness and compassion and love and showing up and letting the other person have their emotions, right? And sometimes that's super easy. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. You have emotions. Great. I feel the distance there. But where I get challenged is like, if I did something slightly wrong, or if I did something like, this is like I'm struggling sometimes to find the limit between how much responsibility do I take and how much do I kind of go, hey, that's your experience. I'm going to let you have your experience. I'm here to support you if you need me, kind of thing. Does that make sense? Does that?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember level 5. Is it still called the dance between control and surrender?
It's called just control and surrender, but yes.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an example of that. We have to do this dance between control and surrender. We have to do this dance between connection and, you know, sovereignty, separation, mm-hmm. and our partners. We have to do this dance between concern for our partner's feelings versus it's my responsibility to keep you from ever feeling bad in any way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So that's life, is finding that balance in all of those polarities. And so most couples come to me very enmeshed, where if one person gets triggered or has an upset, the other one gets upset because they're upset, and then they just ping pong back and forth.
Right.
So usually the work is to separate a little bit more and have some more sovereignty.
Mm.
Kindness, most people need that more than the opposite. There are some people that err more toward the sociopathic, where they're just like, I don't care how you feel, I'm going to do whatever I want. And I would reevaluate that relationship if the person treated me that way, you know? So mm-hmm. yes, we want kindness and respect. But like I said, giving the gift of presence and empathy is the kindness for their feelings, because usually we aren't intentionally trying to make our partner feel awful.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we do that?
Right.
So there might be something I need to own there that I'm not seeing, but let's first start with giving the gift of presence and empathy. So because I'm a relationship coach, I hold myself to a very high standard. And I like to say my superpower is being able to set aside my own upset to be able to hold the space for my partner's upset. Mm-hmm. And so when that situation happens, I say, okay, come on, here's a chance to practice this. So I may even be the one that was upset first, but I didn't handle it very well and I didn't communicate very well. And then now he's upset because of something stupid I said. And so now I have to put my original upset aside and say, yeah, I'm sorry I said that mean thing. You know, how are you feeling about hearing that? And then he's like, well, that didn't feel very good. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, I'm hearing you say that, you know, that hurt your feelings and la, la, la. Is there anything else? Well, yeah, this and that and the other thing. Okay, I hear this and that and the other thing. Is there anything else? So I'm choosing to give the gift of presence and empathy and reflective listening mm-hmm. until he is completely regulated again, because I'm not going to get what I want while he's upset from something I said from being upset. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So, right. So I have to continue to set aside my stuff and give him, be as patient and loving, not do it with a tone in my voice of like, okay, I hear you saying this, but like really drop my shit for a minute and just say, yeah, I can see how that would have been hard to hear. You know, mm-hmm. is there anything else? And then finally, when he says no, say, okay, is there anything you need right now? You know, do you need reassurance? Whatever. Okay. When he's finally okay and he's totally fine and he's emptied out and feels heard and understood, then I can say, do you feel like you're in a good place to hear what was going on for me and why I said that thing that I said? And he might say, no, I'm exhausted now from all this processing. Let's do it later tonight or tomorrow. Or he might say, yeah, go ahead. So then I can say, yeah, I did say that stupid thing to you. And I think what was going on was, you know, I can do some exploration in myself and start to learn like things about myself and use the relationship as an opportunity to learn, like, why did I behave that way? I can't expect him to hold the space for me to do that work until he's regulated. When we're both dysregulated, neither of us is going to get what we need. So we either have to go apart from each other, get regulated some other way and come back when we're calm. But even then, one of you is still going to have to hold the space for the other first and reflective listen and make sure they're feeling understood before the other gets a turn, right? So, but if you feel like you can do it right then, and you don't have to take a pause, if you feel like you can give the other person that gift of presence and empathy, then do it and you'll get through it a lot faster.
I love that. Beautiful.
It's not easy. It takes a lot of work, but I do find that it makes the fights much shorter.
Right. Well, and if it was easy, one, everybody would be doing it, and two, you'd be without a job. But yeah, no, and I think it's interesting, right? And I feel like that's where a lot of us, I certainly found my growth edges there, right? Yeah. I think that's a beautiful place to close. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today. This was delightful.
You're welcome. I loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us for our episode today. If you like the topics of the High podcast, check out our workshops. We do them online and in person. Learn more on high.org. That is HAI.org. See you soon.